Welcome to Taking Back Our Corners, the officially unofficial podcast for We Own This City on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about season one, episode two. Or I don't even know if it's season one. It's probably just episode two. It's a limited series. Aaron, what'd you think of this episode?
I liked it. This is an episode where they're literally and metaphorically building the case. They're building, you've got the federal investigators building a case against these Baltimore Police Department cops. You've got David Simon and George Pelicanos building the same case, except for they're indicting the entire police. Because, like, You're already seeing the kind of like broad strokes of they're not saying that Wayne Jenkins is necessarily a bad guy, but he's definitely a bad cop. And it seems like the Baltimore Police Department is a factory that churns out. They take raw material, which is, you know, new recruits that have been instructed to do the job correctly and to have cultural sensitivity. And on day one, that is beat out of them. And instead, it's just the almost wartime martial law rules of what the beat cops think their job is on Baltimore, which is just has very little relation to actual policing. And I thought that stuff was interesting. As far as the investigation, you know, we're in the middle of it. This time jumping back and forth, I feel like is maybe a weakness in this early episode because we know so much more than the investigators do. We're just kind of waiting for them to stumble upon these connections that we've already made and we can already see. And that's odd that, like, you know, that stuff feels a little perfunctory and there's like some aha moments, but we're, which makes me think there might be a couple more secrets that we don't, or maybe the secret is how high does this go up? Because we hear about the sergeant who's since been promoted to the DEA. Mm-hmm. So there's lots of that. And then the Steele stuff I think is interesting too. It still seems a lot expository where she's just kind of going around and is in the audience position of asking questions. We're all like, why is this happening? Why is this policing the way it is? And finding the surprising / infuriating answers. Yeah. And also continues to be extremely well acted and well shot show. Mm-hmm. Some funny dialogue here and there. What did you think?
I mean this was not as good as the first episode to me, but I do appreciate like how they're attacking the angle of, or they're attacking the idea of this broken system from all angles. Like you can see it embedded into every storyline here, right? And that's, you could tell that's ultimately the story that they want to tell is why is the system broken? I don't know if they'll get around to like, hey, what are the fixes for this? But definitely they want to show you that it's not a couple of bad actors here, right? The whole thing is set up to incentivize perversely some bad behaviors. And I feel like they're doing that with every single storyline. Like you get Jamel in there who's talking about like, you want me to come into this group of people and do the right thing? Are you kidding me? You get like, you know, Jenkins, who on day one is being told like, yeah, everything you learned about how to do this the right way, fuck that. By the guy who's there to train him. So, yeah, I mean, how do you expect to withstand that kind of pressure as a new cadet or as a cadet who's just entering the force for the first time? So,
and how multifaceted that pressure is. It's like officially your field training officer saying all that you know is bullshit. It is looking around and seeing the examples people set. It's looking quotas. Around. And it's quotas. It's also money. You know, what are we getting paid for? How much are we getting paid? What is it worth?
When you're getting paid less than your friends because you're doing the right thing, you bringing crabs to the lake house lunch, lake house cookout, you get laughed at for that. You know, it's like, there's a lot of, it's peer pressure, but it's also like social pressure. It's not even just like, oh, the incentives are perverse because the money is involved. It's like, no, the money is a means to an end as far as fitting in with this group, right? It's all kinds of messed up. And I really like how they're approaching it from every angle.
Yeah, I do too. And that's the thing. It's like, and not only it's all that they it doesn't happen overnight. Like we see 2 years in the course of Jenkins' life and how he goes from idealistic recruit that's kind of in awe of all the people that came before and these officers slain in the line of duty and the honor for the honor of the city of Baltimore and mm-hmm. and all that to a guy who starts bending the rules and then there's another 13 years before the task force happens and another 2 years before the not only do you have this pressure, but like if you do resist it, yes. It's been a year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, and everybody else around, you know, you bring hot dogs to the cookout and they're bringing caviar and lobster. Like, it's one of those things that's like I kept on asking, like, what would I do in this situation? And what is, and when you look, they also show the other side of like, show me the good cop that actually speaks out against the system and tries to do, and what happens to them?
Yeah. You know, they just get put on a useless post and they have to just sit on their hands. They can't do any good, right? Because they're sidelined intentionally.
It's like Lester in The Wire all over again. He's making dollhouse, you know, he's reduced to making dollhouse furniture in the basement somewhere because he's too good. He's too good police.
Yeah.
It's infuriating. I'm watching this and the Treme at the same time. And I watched this episode. And then I watched the episode, I think it's episode 7 of the first season of Treme, where, Clark Peters is moving back into a project house after the hurricane and he gets brutalized by police. And like, you just, that those 2 hours back to back, just you make you want to piss blood. It's interesting. David Simon's Twitter handle is Age of Despair.
Okay.
And I keep going back to, how do you fix this? Like, I understand, like, when you see shows like this and you hear like activists say there's no reforming this, you know, that's bad news because it needs to be reformed. This stuff needs to be fixed. It's getting to the point where even good police can't do their jobs because when they get on the stand, they're looking at 12 yes. people, arms crossed, eyes narrowed, thinking, well, you're a lying son of a bitch.
Yeah, it's a self-perpetuating cycle, right?
Right. So no matter how good the prosecutors, no matter, like, you've probably got a generation of feudal policing ahead of you if you fixed it right now, because it's going to take that long for the citizenry to get the trust back. And the fact that, like, I doubt those things have actually started meaningfully turning around in Baltimore. Maybe I'm wrong. I'd like to be proven wrong. But yeah, it's depressing, infuriating, and still super, super watchable. Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
This Tuesday, we're back off the clock with a new premium podcast covering our experiences with the new Amazon series Fallout, Alex Garland's Civil War, as well as some thoughts on X-Men 97.
Then on Friday, The Old Reliable, Lunch with Jim and Aaron. Join us in the Munch Crowd to watch us record live at 1 p.m. Eastern, or check out the podcast later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds.
You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly Lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today. Should we get into like the discussion?
Yeah. Yeah, let's do it.
Did you know that there's an official podcast?
I think I knew that, but I haven't listened to it.
HBO continues to do their damnedest to put us out of a job, which is okay. I still think we have our corners that we can claim as far as independent coverage, but it's a pretty good one. It's hosted by Dee Watkins, who is one of the head writers of the show, and he's got a fascinating backstory. He is a kid that grew up in Baltimore, got mixed up in the drug scene. I think his story, I might have gotten this wrong, but because I researched him a bit on Wikipedia, and he got to be, I think, 18, and either his friends or one of his brothers got killed, and he decided that scared him straight, and he took all the drug money that he had thus far and invested into a coffee shop and went legit, got himself educated, became a professor at a Baltimore university, has written a bunch of stuff about the Baltimore crime experience, and was personally tapped, was called out of the blue by David Simon. It's like, hey, would you like to join our writer's room? You got an interesting perspective. He actually says in the podcast that he ran around, he got busted several times and had run-ins of altercations with the cops depicted on this show.
Oh boy.
So yeah. The writer's room has got firsthand knowledge of what's going on here. They also had a really great interview with John Bernthal, who said that he, you know, like he was really interested in this show because policing and intersection of justice and race in America is something that he, in a direct quote, has left him confused, frustrated by, passionate about policing. You know, he's portrayed the Punisher, who, you know, has got an unhealthy fixation by some of the law enforcement officers in this country.
Sure.
He talks about the research that he went in this role, which consisted of him watching hours of body cam footage of Wayne Jenkins on stops, him interviewing Wayne Jenkins, talking to him from prison. Slight spoilers for where this is going. It sounds like he's going to keep the purple jammies on.
Yeah, I was going to say he's already there.
Interviewed people that he worked with, his superiors, his coworkers, people on the street that were busted by him and had run-ins with him. And you just get this complicated. He went on a bunch of ride-alongs in every district in Baltimore. And you come away with this idea that, Simon said this too, direct quote, like, we will have failed if we make Wayne Jenkins out to be a singular monster, because that's not what the story is about. And Bernthal said this guy's a really multifaceted guy. This guy's a Marine veteran. A great father, committed husband, everybody that worked with him said he was a great guy. But yet he also victimized the shit out of people and took advantage of the public trust. Mm-hmm. It's also interesting, Bernthal, like, I guess when he's doing these ride-alongs and he's going around the police unit, that he was so convincing as a cop that like some of the one of the suspects took a swing on him, tried to attack him thinking he was a cop. The other thing he thought he revealed about Jenkins is that he said he was a master code switcher, that he could go, you know, if he's talking to his superiors, he could, you know, talk that way. He could talk the people on the street. One of the things he prided himself for is if they got a criminal, they pick someone up and they got their cell phone, that he would go through their phone book and call people in the contacts and pose that he is their friend and was convincing enough to get him to meet up and you know, keep the chain of bus going.
Wow.
It's just really interesting. And I thought it was a great interview, and it got a lot of good personal insight into how kind of committed that Bernthal was to the role and embodying this guy and trying to, you know, again, two episodes in, obviously Jenkins is, I'm much more comfortable saying that he's an obvious shitbird at this point.
Yeah, yeah.
But he was hammered into that shape. And there's some pity to be had. You know, pity for his victims, sure. But also this guy who maybe could have been a great cop and was corrupted by this system. So I'm looking forward to listening to this as we go along throughout the season. And as I get little interesting chunks and nuggets, I'll bring them up to the podcast. So.
Yeah, I'm going to check it out. I didn't have a lot of time last night. I expected to have more time, but I ended up doing a stream that was way longer than I expected.
Yeah.
So I only got to watch this episode once. And boy, can I tell you, the experience of watching this episode was rough for me, because as you guys know, we have screeners, but those screeners do not come with subtitles. And some of the people in this show have serious mush mouth. They mumble. They have accents that are hard to understand sometimes. Yeah. And they're using lingo that is unfamiliar to me. And when I hear them say something, I'm very confused. And I literally spent 2.5 hours watching this 57-minute episode last night, because I had to rewind just over and over and over to try and decipher what the hell did that guy say and how does that connect to everything else.
I have a similar story. I watched this episode once as soon as we got done recording the last episode, and it was like I no longer was afraid that I'd spoil anything.
Yeah.
So I watched this and I enjoyed it, and then, you know, a couple days later, I allotted a full 3 hours for my research and note taking. Pass, and I thought that'd be plenty. Like, in fact, I'd have a bunch of time to, like, you know, look up some cases and stuff. It took all of that 3 hours just to write the notes, get all the characters, and
yeah,
because like you said, I had to like back up like 10-15 times, and so I was like, what the fuck is he saying about core cases?
And I'm still getting used to some of the character names, so I don't know who everybody is,
right?
Like by name so much, so I have to look people up, and that took a while.
Right.
And
I was Detective Marlowe Stanfielding a lot of stuff in this episode,
for sure.
But and the thing is, like, I feel some of it is I don't even need to, because I think there's some of these ideas, like, that it seems like Simon and Pelicanos like to just kind of like slip in there. And they're going to elaborate, and you know, they're telling a story in a certain way, and you're going to have aha moments as we go on, where you make those connections organically. You don't have to really,
yeah, probably,
you know, force them out.
But like we said that first time, we're podcasters. We prefer to understand what's happening in the episode from a detail perspective. But
yeah, that's why they pay us the quote unquote big bucks. That's why we're taking home the bushel of the big crabs, the fat crabs, the fat meaty crabs.
These medium crabs.
Get these medium crabs out of here. We're looking for the fat.
$47 worth of crab. I could eat $47 worth of crab.
It's hardly worth sprinkling the Old Bay on them, to tell you the truth. Right. We want them fat meaty crabs here. We're taking back our corners and our crabs. So I threaded this the thread that kind of holds this episode together is the official federal investigation, and it ranges a lot of different places. It's Detective McDougal and Kilpatrick them working with the feds. It's the feds interviewing Jamel Rayum. There's a lot to talk about here. We start off with Wayne shouting at this Jamel guy to keep his mouth shut. They don't got nothing. He meets with the FBI officers and or agents and immediately decides, you know what? Fuck it. And kind of spills his guts.
Yeah.
Why?
Because he cutting the deal?
It seems like a smart play, because yeah. I think when the FBI gets their claws into you, it's one thing if you haven't done anything wrong, but if you haven't doing the wrong on the scale of these guys, they probably have enough to put you away without your cooperation. So it's kind of a race to who's going to cooperate first is going to be get the best deal, and the people to hold out are going to be sailed up the river.
Yeah, they've probably already made some kind of a case. I feel like they sort of go over that in this episode.
I thought it was interesting that he waived his right to a lawyer. He mentioned, like, well, am I going to pay $500 an hour for a lawyer? Because, like, even having a public defender would be better than literally nothing. But I think he's just like, I'm just going to throw myself at the mercy of these feds and see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
And then the stuff that we get out of him is just the widespreadness of the corruption. And it's interesting to see these FBI agents I think that's one of the tensions in this episode, is like, how high are they going to go? Because if you remember, one of the ironies of The Wire is, you know, it starts off this low level street crime, and they go up to and investigate into Barksdale's organization. But then they find out that there's this corruption goes all the way up into the mayor's office. There's corruption at the federal level. And there is very little interest in getting much higher than the street level crime officially. Like that stuff is kind of shut down. Ah, well, let's make our cases and closures and move on. They hint that there's a sergeant that's since been promoted to the DEA.
Mm-hmm. And they make a case for the mayor being complicit in all this too, right? They say, like, look, if the shooting comes down, the crime rate comes down, the mayor gets to be governor, right?
Right. And that this is politics.
And it's a form of the corruption that's going on in the police department. It's certainly helped to perpetuate that.
Yeah. But even that like you got the, you know, the lieutenant and sergeant seemed like the federal agents are aghast that like even the, this isn't just like one rogue officer. This is like goes into the leadership and, Jamail explains that like they're even worse because, you know, there's all kinds of tricks a beat cop can play, like a rank and file to get more overtime and did that. But like they have to do admin tasks and paperwork and you don't get overtime for that. So they're even hungrier for that ill-gotten gains. And there's even like all these perverse incentives, you know?
Yeah.
One of the questions I came up with is like, what is a fair wage to pay a cop? Because on the official podcast, D Money or D Wilkins and Bernthal are talking about these guys, you know, like feathering their nest a little bit because they don't feel like they got paid enough to go out there. And they're kind of joking about, well, you saw what the pay is when you joined up. And like, well, one of the reasons that we pay like our politicians so much money, you know, the reason we pay our president $500,000 a year and we pay our senators like $250,000, the idea is that you pay. It's not like that, you know, the being a state senator or whatever is hard. It's like you pay them a fair amount of money so that they are not vulnerable to these types of corruptions.
Yeah, which I feel like doesn't work because some people are inherently greedy and infinitely greedy. Yeah, like there is no amount of money you can pay somebody where they won't say, I want a little bit more if you catch the right person, right?
But it seems like when the hiring, something that I wanted to show a touch on, but like, yeah, I've heard that like when we're hiring police officers, like you don't want them to be too educated. You don't want them to be, you don't want them to be too middle class. You don't want to be too intelligent because, you know, this is kind of like you're realizing they're offering a raw deal. Go out there for $35,000 and you might get shot. You might get beat up. You might not make it home. I'm wondering, it's like, is there like, should we pay our police officers more money so that they don't feel like they have to do this to provide for their family? It's not a silver bullet, but I do think that the more the officers are paid, the more that they would feel comfortable like dropping a dime on someone who's on the dole.
Yeah. I mean, a livable wage, right? I mean, that's the thing, yeah. Like the livable wage, and that definition varies, for people all over the country, right? What's livable here in Cincinnati is not going to be livable in San Francisco. But yeah, we should absolutely pay the people who are there to protect and serve a livable wage. If we're not, what the hell are we doing? Now, I don't know what that means when it comes to, hey, I have five kids. Like what's livable also for someone with no kids is not livable for someone with five kids. So
yeah. Yeah.
How do you square that circle, whatever? I don't know. But yeah, I think like you need to give those people the assurance that if they play by these rules and if they do things the right way, they will be taken care of. And I think it's all you can do, right?
Yeah. They also show some of the investigative techniques that they're using. Like they picked up this Aaron Anderson. I think is that Brill or is Brill Shropshire? It's the guy who got busted at the hotel after his apartment got busted into by Shropshire last episode. Anderson. They have a couple ticky-tacky prior convictions that they're escalating into because because his whole stash house is gone. He didn't have any cash. He didn't have any weapons. They have 100 grams of whatever drug, which isn't a lot.
From ages ago, though, right? Like, wasn't this a prior...
I wasn't quite sure if like, because the other thing we know about this guy is he is already a cooperator too. He's cooperated before.
Yeah, but it seems like they're re-pulling his old arrest to get him to do more here.
And I know there's also things called like, you know, when you have certain priors that like they, if you get picked up again, they can like, even if you've paid your time on that, they can escalate. Like if you have a misdemeanor misdemeanor assault can turn into a felony charge if you get picked up for another bar fight 5 years from now.
Sort of like and they're breaking using your probation or something, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's just a way to, penalize repeat offenders more. And they're using these powers to lean against this guy to make him cooperate against his will, that kind of stuff. But this is how they find out. This is the first time they get the idea that this Shropshire is tight with this guy named G Money, who is a cop that works on narcotics. Because, again, these investigators don't know the shit we know. They don't know about the... Marmaduke or whatever his name is.
Yeah, Marmaduke Gondo is what they refer to him mostly as.
So they get enough information to get a wire on Shropshire and a tracker on their car, and this yields information almost immediately because Shropshire takes his, you know, in the course of doing business, he takes his car to the shop. The shop guy's like, "Yo, we got a GPS tracker on him." He makes a naked in the air phone call to G Money.
Yeah.
And tells him about it. And he's like, let me hit you up on FaceTime, which is untraceable. The cops ponder this, but I don't think I got a good answer.
Why is
G-Moto or whatever, why is he so careless? Because
I feel like their answer of, well, he's sloppy and we got lucky is not very satisfying. It might be true, but it doesn't feel like it should be.
Yeah, he's aware enough to like, well, we shouldn't be having this conversation. Let's have it on FaceTime, which isn't trackable. But then he calls him back and says, oh, yeah, I've looked into it. And this means that you're being followed. And he uses the cover of like, I don't know you.
I don't know who I'm talking to. What?
This reminds me of people like on the internet when they say when they're doing drug research and they got, I'm asking for a friend.
Totally.
Like,
yeah.
Like everybody on Arrowwind and on the Reddit drug forums are always like, a friend of mine says, I'm like, dude, if the feds kick your door in.
There's like, you go through their search history and it's like 600 searches for Silk Road and Bitcoin and like.
Right. And they got their wallet unencrypted right there. And oh, yeah.
Because that's what this is, right? Like you look at the list of phone numbers that they pull up on this guy and this guy's talked to him 400 times in the last 2 years or whatever. Obvious there's a pattern here and he knows exactly who this guy is. If you dig even and that's interesting to me is when Jamel is talking to the FBI, he's saying IAD is fucking stupid. Like, yeah. I wasn't sloppy. They're just dumb and I knew it. And
couldn't catch clap in a whorehouse. Great line.
And that's wild to me. Like, that seems like the basic part of doing your job is to check these types of things, follow up on things that seem suspicious. And, you know, I don't know how deep like corruption runs in the IAD or if like there's a legitimate fear from cops from the IAD that they could catch them doing things and they're just bad at their jobs. I don't know, but it's probably wild.
When you look at guys like Herschel who have 50 complaints that, you know, don't generate anything. Is that because IAD is bad at their job? Is it because it's really hard? It's like, you know, IAD might say, well, we've investigated this guy. He should be working, but between the union and the Fraternal Order of Police and the rank and file, like it's just impossible. So like, also like, I think there's a lot of, you know, like IAD, like, do they really want to bust these guys? Because some of this stuff was incredible. Like him like failing a polygraph and lying about knowing his partner when they went through basic training together and they've got all kinds of phone calls and the guy's like, oh, they never bothered to look that. I guess you guys did. It does paint a pretty grim picture of the, you know, who watches the watchers. Well, you know, effectively nobody. And while even the heat that this guy did get, that Jamel got, amounted to a 2-year paid vacation.
The icing on the cake. Yeah.
And he rejoined the force. He just rejoined. They just threw him into like the professional criminal department.
Yeah.
Like why? And you got to think that it seems like all these guys, they're starting to build the case in episode 2 that all these guys on this gun trace task force, with one notable exception, McClool, were handpicked because they're dirty. and that they can skim.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's like Bernthal heading that up, Jenkins heading that up, like hand picking these guys, saying give them to me because he knows that they won't rat on him. He knows that they'll fall in line with him, or if this is coming from somebody else. But yeah, it does seem like it's just a whole task force full of people who have no regard for the law.
And it's like they also show like how far the effects of the, because a lot of people like, well, okay, if you're a gangbanger, you're a drug guy, you're a corner boy running around, you might get this or that. But they make they do a good job of showing how this catches the so-called civilians up too, because this one guy that gets pulled over, his crime is he's got $11,000. He wasn't wearing a seatbelt, allegedly.
Mm-hmm. Allegedly.
Sure. He had $11,000 in his backpack because he just got back from the bank, and this was the equity of what do you call that? A second mortgage, a home refinancing.
Yeah.
And the cops took it from him and says, if you want to, you bring your bank paperwork. You read between the lines because they don't actually connect this dots, but as soon as they got this to evidence room, they just split the money. So this guy brings his bank paperwork back. It's like, well, that cash isn't here. He's got no recourse. I mean, this is the civil forfeiture is, if you know anything about policing, is a huge problem and a huge source of corruption. Because if you want to go buy a car and pay cash for it and you get stopped and you have over, I think, $5,000, certainly $10,000, that is sufficient evidence for them to steal your money, because you have insane. to prove it wasn't drug money. It's assumed to be drug money, and none of the search and seizure laws that would protect you as an American citizen apply, because the crazy thing is the courts have interpreted the law to the cops are indicting your money, not you, and your cash got no rights.
What does that even mean? What does that even mean? That sounds insane to me.
We live in a country where dollar bills have more freedom of speech than the average.
Yeah, totally.
You know, like it's fucking insane. But
every dollar gets a vote, and I can have a billion of them. Sure.
And this is some black guy who's, you know, trying to get his piece of the American dream. He's refinanced his house. He's saved money. He's doing all the things that you're supposed to do.
Right.
And the people who are supposed to protect and serve him have robbed him fucking blind.
Mm-hmm.
And what's this guy going to do in a jury 5 years from now when you need to put away a murderer or a rapist or something?
Right.
It's
infuriating.
There's also something that I also didn't quite understand is Special Agent Jensen, the lady FBI agent, goes to investigate this, or not investigate, to question a Sergeant Gwynn who put a complaint against Gondo a long time ago, a couple of years ago, which I guess the FBI did investigate. And he mentioned there's like this is big secret cloak and dagger thing where they're like, we'll meet, you know, be on this such and such a corner outside this gallery. They pull up in an unmarked van, open up the side door, take him, and nothing ever. Again, I guess my question is, how far up into the federal agency does this corruption go? Because like this guy says, look, you know, when you get a gut feeling that you know is right, it was an open secret that Schropp was moving serious weight. And this Gondo guy who said he grew up and was friends with this guy says it's not true.
Yeah.
Like that dog don't hunt. How did this not get caught before?
Yeah. I don't know. I'm interested to see where this corruption is going to intersect with the FBI, if at all. Because right now, everything we've seen from the FBI has been above board.
Yeah. And then also, I think this Cluel guy is super interesting. He's the choir boy that we saw last episode.
For like a second, yeah.
For like a second. He is apparently the only one that is not dirty in this whole sad deal. Although I think he is the white officer who's standing kind of with his hands in his vest as the two gun task force guys are robbing a civilian of his $11,000.
I didn't see him in that. I was more focused on what was happening in the foreground.
Yeah, I was wondering because like my question is how is a clean cop stay clean? Like, do you not commit crimes of omission? Like, you can't not be seeing what's going on. These guys are super flagrant about it. Mm-hmm. Or maybe they're just really careful not to draw this guy's attention or ire. I don't know. Because I can see Kluel fitting into this task force because Bernthal or Jenkins is saying all the right things. Like, you know, get good stops, build your case, make sure you got, mm-hmm. you know, be able to put these guys away, et cetera, et cetera.
And if Kluel is standing in that scenario where they're stealing this guy's $11,000, I mean, if civil forfeiture law is what it is, and he sees that, well, this is just by the books, right? Like taking this guy's $11,000 is something they should do according to the interpretation of this law. He might not know that they took that money and split it. Like he might find out later that the money isn't there, but where did it go, right? Like,
because he was rolling like when they were theatrically asking, "Oh, home refund? Oh, they'll say anything here out on these streets." So he's rolling his eyes too, like you're like, "Oh yeah, tell us." Like, I just think that's wild that someone run around at $10,000 is just like you're a drug dealer.
Yeah, no, that's insane.
I have personally rolled around $15,000 when I the exact thing I talk about. I went to go buy a car in Lafayette, and unbeknownst to me, if I'd got stopped anywhere between Mooresville and Lafayette. Now that I think of it, there's signs that says that's a drug corridor, which makes perfect sense. It's between Indianapolis and Chicago.
If
I got pulled over for a ticket, they would have stolen that shit from me.
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy.
Get cashier's checks, kids, I guess, and hope the guy you're buying a car from is going to accept it. God damn. Mm-hmm. Pisses me out. Anyway.
There's a lot of infuriating stuff like that in this show.
Yes,
to put it mildly. That Nicole talking with Herzl later, we'll get to that, is just infuriating. But
Let's move on to, because that's the next thread, the Department of Justice civil rights lawyer Nicole Steele is going about investigation. We start off in her office like we did before, and all the lawyers are listening to the hottest new banger coming out from the streets of Baltimore, Young Moose.
Sure.
Who's calling out Officer Herzl by name and blowing him up on this track. And, you know, again, explain for the slow members of the audience, the reason this guy's able to get away with it is because none of his charges stick, which I'm very curious. I'm very curious how he makes these complaints go away, because it seems like there's got to be something he's doing to threaten these people. I think that's kind of what they're hinting at. That if you give these people shit, that they are just going to make your life living hell. They will pull you over every single time you drive your car to your work. They'll toss your shit. They'll harass you. They'll call you. And more importantly, he's still willing to get out of the car and make arrests when apparently there are other cops in Baltimore aren't.
This is wild. Young Moose is an actual rapper. So the reality of this series extends even to Young Moose. Actual rapper sued the Gun Trace Task Force detective Daniel Herzl for harassment and wrongful arrest, all that stuff, in like 2021, which is wild. Ooh. It took that long.
I wonder how much of the book like was a bombshell before the series was, you know,
right.
How much, but that's still, we're talking about getting justice longer after the fact. So Steele goes to meet with this Mr. Drummer, who is, I think a lawyer for the city, or maybe he's an activist. He's a defense attorney she wants to know, who's represented some of these victims of Herzl, and she wants to get some phone numbers so she can start making some phone calls. And this essentially sets up all the interviews that she has. Mm-hmm. She gets them all from this Mr. Drummer guy. And Steele's just going around trying to get someone to inform her on what's going on. So she talks to a couple of guys at Herschel's beat down. She tracks down Young Moose. And he says that, you know, this guy's been harassing me. He gives charges. He runs through my pockets every time he stops, just stealing from him. Then when she goes outside from this interview, she gets a call from an officer who meets her at Leakin Park. If Leakin Park sounds familiar and you didn't mistake it for Linkin Park,
like I did.
You might recognize this. This is the infamous location that surrounded the Serial season one murder of Hay Lee. Her body was dropped in this park. But anyway, there's a Baltimore officer who's only 32 and has been put out to pasture at this dead end post because he's got a big mouth. He's got loud public opinions about policing and how it should be and how it is, and his superiors don't want to hear it. Mm-hmm. This guy really brings out from a street level, like, what is going on. Do you have any insights or anything to talk about with this guy?
No, it's a lot of stuff that they talked about in the first episode, right? Like, the work slowdown stuff is causing cops not to get out of their cars. And this guy is like, well, you know, there are less arrests after Freddie Gray, but guys won't get out of their cars not because they're afraid of cell phones, right? It's to spite, he says, Mosby, who at the time is, I'm not sure if it's at the time, but right now is the state's attorney.
Yep. She joined up in 2015, so right, she's brand okay. new. They're referring, I looked
and she
her
prosecuted
up
and, a lot of the cops who were involved in the Freddie Gray stuff. That whole fiasco. So, which actually, she was just indicted on perjury for a whole bunch of mortgage and loan scandals, and I'm like, oh Jesus, I do wonder, like, how much of that is retaliatory.
Yeah, like if you wrote down your income as 65,000, like 75,000 instead of 74,000, that's technically right. perjury on those what do they call those FHA loans?
Yeah,
those are federal documents.
So some of it was pandemic relief stuff too. Like, she took out a $40,000 loan when in fact her salary went up that year and she had no hardship whatsoever, as best you could tell. And she lied, on mortgages to get lower rates.
Everybody's hands in everybody's pockets in Baltimore, seems like.
It seems like it, man. Even the people Jesus. Who are seemingly prosecuting the bad guys are also taking their share. It's fucking wild. But yeah, so that's the thing. Like,
but you also wonder how much of that is like retaliation. Absolutely, like, if there's like, she pissed off a bunch of people and they're like, is, but who knows? Because like you said, this is Baltimore.
Yeah. And it was interesting to me just to see, like, okay, some of this corruption is anger too, right? Like, you think, okay, you want the cops getting out of their cars, making proper arrests, but like, they're pissed off at the person who's prosecuting their partners and friends, and they now won't get out of their cars to make arrest. It's, yeah, there's just a lot of stuff here going on.
Yeah, and not just because they're afraid to police because there's the cameras. It's also right. just vindictive. Like, exactly. They're just not going to do it because they want this person to look bad. They want to make a point. It reminded me of, like, man, I see this shit from cops. You remember the George Floyd protests? There was one that really sticks out in my mind in Buffalo, New York, where there's this riot control officers specialist department that was like going through, and they approached this old man who's about 75 years old,
yep.
and they just violently shoved him to the ground. This guy's head split like a melon. The officer to shove them started to stop, like, he's like, oh fuck, I should do. And his other fellow officers came up and said, fuck this guy, keep marching. And when that became a national disgraceful headline, as it should be, every cop in that detachment quit en masse in protest of them being held accountable.
Wow.
For destroying the 75-year-old man's cranium when they're wearing full, like, these weren't just like cops in plain clothes or like in no, plain no. clothes, or they were wearing riot helmets, face masks. They had shields, batons. There was 40 of the fuckers.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway,
yeah.
They make this point, though, that's like, because like we heard about how you're losing the street, and they made that point really eloquent last episode, where they have all these police brutality scenes with all the people in Baltimore just looking angry and pissed at the camera. Mm-hmm. But here it's like he said it's even worse than you think, because this is now affecting our jury. So even us cops that are doing things right, who are crossing our T's and dotting our I's, can't get a conviction. These prosecutors can't get a conviction because there's not a jury in Baltimore that you can select that's going to convict anybody.
It makes, and there's also, it makes proper policing impossible.
Yeah. And it's like, they also show like the perils of this this street level harassment. There's young man who's walking home from work. He's crime is he has a knife that's about an inch and a half long on him. They stop and runs
to
his pocket
area, and he's scared. He's walking home at night. Sure.
And but even like, fuck, man, there's many times in my life I carried a full 3-inch blade because knives are handy. And sure. I don't know. Like, I don't know what it's like to be in Baltimore. But and this guy, he is, you know, saying this is bullshit. And he's not, I would say, going peacefully. But there's 6 cops there. And this is a skinny 17-year-old kid, maybe. And they throw him to the ground, and next thing we see, he's got this vicious gash on his head that's got like 17, 18 stitches.
Yeah, this is the kind of stuff.
And again, for what? Like, because he was walking through a high crime area with a hoodie on.
Yeah, it's the kind of stuff that's so egregious that it's hard to believe that it actually happens. But I've seen enough at this point of cell phone footage and body cam footage. Oh, yeah. And I've like, if I were 20 years younger and I'm thinking, oh man, look at this show, I start to think, like, surely this didn't really happen. Things like this can't happen in real life, right? It's so beyond the pale.
Or it's the exception. It's not systemic, sure.
Right, right. It doesn't happen all over the city at all hours of the day. But no, I've seen enough now to know this is just how it works routinely in some places. And it's crazy.
Yeah, and it's terrible because also they do stuff that's I think it's interesting that Pelicanos and Simon are kind of heading some arguments off the past, because a lot of and I remember when I first started paying attention to this racial justice stuff, one of the things that was mentioned is we can't have policing areas that don't look like the people they're policing. Essentially saying you get white suburban cops going into urban inner cities and they're racist and they're inherently biased against these people. But most of the cops involved in this stop were black. They looked just like the guy, and they're perfectly capable of violating his civil rights and beating the shit out of him and brick him in the face. Apparently, it's not enough to just get your licks in. You gotta hit this kid's head with a rock.
Yeah, for money and quotas and
or just to enforce your fucking will. You know. Sure.
Yeah,
like it's not enough that a person you take a person into custody, they have to like thank you and yes sir you and be ultra respectful, and like cops are less able to handle the de-escalated situation than your average fucking McDonald's cashier. And they have guns
because they don't have to, right? You might, I don't know, you might get fired from McDonald's. Are you going to get fired from the police force? Not likely.
Apparently, it's impossible. Yeah. Apparently, it's impossible. And there's this, I thought it's a cute scene where Miss Steele interviews this kid, Samuels, and she talks about it. And at the end of it, he's like, do you think it's going to ruin me for girls? And she is, I guess, and you're going to be all right. And he's got kind of the shy smile. Mm-hmm. That's something else. If you guys like the show, you really need to listen to season 3 of Serial, because there's tons of examples of good kids getting caught up in this. Kids that believe in the system, kids that are honor roll students at high school, and they get run to this shit and it ruins them. Like, think about like if you were 17 and a cop disfigured you. And there's nothing you can do about it. What are you going to feel about the system that did that? Like, if you weren't criminal, if you weren't fuck 12, if you weren't this, you know, fuck the police before, you're going to be now.
And there's no avoiding it, right? Like standing on the corner and still being there when the cops roll around the block is not the only way to get this shit to happen to you, right? You could literally just be walking home from school, textbooks in your hands, and get the shit beat out of you by the authorities. Like, it's that is never going to work long term. And I love like all the scenes that they show of like Jenkins being indoctrinated and him like just rounding kids up and finding weed. And we could talk about it more later, but like that to me is just like, you know, you're not doing anything effective here. You know it. Everyone knows it. And yet you keep doing it. For what?
Yeah, and they also show the social cost of this, too, because, I like I said, this guy's permanently disfigured now. But he also mentioned, thank God I wasn't on shift that day or I would have lost my job. Can you imagine? For doing nothing but walking home, you get permanently disfigured, you lose your job. Now what are you going to do?
Yeah.
You know, you still got to find a place to live. You still got to provide. It's just like, it's turning civilians. It's like there's a factory that turns cops into shitbirds, mm-hmm. and there's a factory that turns civilians into criminals.
Yeah.
You know, and they feed back how we reverse it. Yeah. how he reverses. I hope Simon Pelicanos has something to say in episode 5 or 6 about how he might reverse this thing, because Jesus.
Right.
Then we get the hammer of the steel sequence, which she tracks down Herschel at his bar. He's eating buffalo wings, massively disrespectful. He's licking his fingers and he's offering her his slimy, greasy hand, which is such a fucking great metaphor for this show.
Mm-hmm.
She's trying to just ask, and she's saying, like, look, I'm not here as in a criminal capacity. I'm just here trying to get information to try to write a report on how to make this thing better. And this guy, this fucker is smart. He hasn't gotten out of 50 of these things for nothing. He's like, you know what? The reason I beat these cases, because these are criminals that are complaining about being policed. And that's all I got to say about that.
Sure.
But
we've seen that's not true already, right? They show us last episode that these are all lies.
Right. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he just stonewalls her, and it's incredible.
I have a feeling it's going to be the Tale of Two Cops, and Jenkins gets railroaded, and Herschel, like, he's still going to be on the boat post by the end of this fucking show.
Yeah,
and
that would make a lot of sense.
I'm getting the catheter ready
because
I can't piss that much blood. Like, it's just like, right. I just need some way to just rapidly dispose of it. So
piss directly into the dialysis machine, man.
Yes. Yeah. Put it back into my system. I'll dehydrate. I'll just turn into a dust bag.
Uh-huh.
Let's move to Detective Sean Suter. This is Detective Marlo Stanfield, from The Wire. This just shows, the tale of two cops continues, because you got the murder police. You join the episode. They're hiking through the parking lot trying to find a vehicle so they can go investigate a crime. Meanwhile, G Money is coming by, and they got employee of the month parking lots, because they jump corners and steal cash, and they're just trying to fuck them. They're just trying to clear murders,
right.
They also show, like, what these guys are, because this is this guy's first murder case, and a sergeant puts him on something alone because I guess he's short on bodies. And, he's like, oh, I got confidence in you. No, you don't. You just don't have any other better option. And this guy goes to work. He starts investigating, sees this is probably not a criminal. He's got calluses. He's a working man. He's looking at the alley. He's collecting evidence. He's looking at where the shells are on the ground. He's lining up his shots to see, like, where the guy was standing. You can kind of get that McNulty and Bunk. Like, you can see this guy breaking down his crime scene. He's very, very smart.
Mm-hmm.
He interviews this man who got shot in the alley's wife. We find out this guy's name is Kendall. This guy heard a noise outside, went to investigate. The shot started firing. Her kids ran to a closet because that's what they trained them to do after a bullet went through their bedroom window last year. And she ran outside just in time to see her husband laying there, shot 5 times, in a pool of his own blood. And he picks apart there's this partially completed fence. Do you have any clue? Because, like, it seems like the city's theory of the case is that him fencing off his backyard angered drug dealers, and he got slain for that.
Yeah, but
I don't think
Suter's he shot him 5 times. It's a little angry for a fence, right?
Right. And, like, since he's the smart guy that I'm watching doing a bunch of smart things this episode, I tend to, like, want to follow his story. But I also don't understand. Did this guy just get caught in the wrong place at the wrong time?
Maybe. I don't know. I don't think we have enough information yet. The thing that I really latched onto was the PR stunt that they're turning this into, right? Like, going and building the fence for this family, is going to somehow, like, smooth over the fact that you've done nothing and, in fact, exacerbated the crime problem in your city.
Yeah, can we get this woman and child on WIC? Can we pay for these kids' education? Can we, no, but we can fucking build a fence in front of so the camera crew can catch it and we look like fucking heroes. But even the cops are cynical enough. They're like, well, you know what? Like, shit, it might get us enough goodwill to get a lead or two. So at least we got some the light on the subject. He also is talking to this guy with this sweet ass, like, Impala.
Those small wins, right? That's so stupid and short-sighted. It's infuriating. Because, like, okay, yeah, you speak about goodwill, but you don't actually care about goodwill.
Yeah. This guy, he's trying to build up, he's trying to build a rapport with this guy who's out waxing his sweet ass 95 Impala with the candy, the metallic candy paint. and they talk about that, and they bond over the fact that, you know, this guy's got, I think, two or three cars, and Detective Marlowe's got five fucking kids.
Yeah.
He tells him, you know, you might want to put that bud in the bag, another Wire reference, and he gives him his card, and it's like, you can see this guy is skeptical. You know, like, if I let, you know, like, if I let you know, number one, are you going to be able to catch this guy, put him away, and am I going to catch a bullet for my trouble?
Yeah.
Then he goes back to headquarters. He's got something in his mailbox that he says is a promising ballistic lead. I'm hoping this leads him to, you know, I'm assuming this is something to do with this shot, that they ran some analysis in the casing and they got a hit on something. Mm-hmm. I have no idea. Like, if... Is this gonna relate to the gun? It would be interesting if the gun task trace force's work ends up direct, because, you know, we just saw last episode Jenkins have that big old thing of gun and talk about, oh, maybe this ballista is gonna help you out. It'd be interesting if this stuff actually ends up being the thing that starts to bring down the gun trace task force.
Mm-hmm.
But it also seems like the Fed's investigation is also, a thing that's gonna bring them down too. Who knows?
Yeah.
Which brings us, save the biggest shitbird for last, Wayne Jenkins. This is a sad story of how a guy who, by all accounts, probably wanted to be a good cop and was trained to be a good cop by the academy is beat into a thug by the system. We start with, in August 2003, newly minted patrol officer Jenkins. He's walking into his first police briefing. He's walking past rows of plaques honoring slain officers died in execution of their public duty service, honoring their department. He's kind of soaking it all in. And his training officer grabs him and says, everything that you've heard about policing and about due process and about cultural sensitivity, fuck that shit. And it's not just that, but, like, I don't know what it's like to be a police, but I do know what it's like to be a programmer. And I've walked in on day one on jobs where I'm like, wow, I'm surrounded by professionals that are, you know, not. And I've also walked into places where everyone is self-evidently have their thumbs up their asses and have checked out and don't give a shit.
Uh-huh.
And when your boss gets up there and says, just clear the corners, it doesn't matter, we don't give it. And one of your fellow police said, this is bullshit. Does not. And it's like, I don't care. It's what the mayor wants. Mm-hmm. Like, that all sets a tone. And it's a hell of a tone.
Yeah, absolutely. Like Jamel says later, like, you really expect me to go into this corrupt organization and be a beacon of hope and light? I don't think so. I seriously don't see how you can accept that or expect that. And like all the stuff like we see later, and well, in these early scenes, like they're intercutting between this field training that he's doing and him being arrested in the current timeline, I guess, the most recent timeline, and sitting in a cell and just thinking about all the things he's done, right? Like, these are almost flashbacks that he's thinking of during this episode. And you know, you start to see the facade break down in this episode. He's the guy who will look the police commissioner right in the eye when nobody else will, and he's cocky as hell. And he I was thinking, like, is he cocky or is he just in denial that anything he did was wrong? And I think there's a little bit of both things in there, but you start to see both the trouble that he's in and also maybe the wrong that he's done sink in this episode.
And that's the thing, is like, he wasn't that cocky guy here. He's kind of like, as he's kind of frowning, kind of unsure. It's like, oh, you know, I don't know. Yeah. It's like, it's in not like when training. This guy's like, fuck your cultural sensitivity, fuck your search. He's not like, hell yeah, I'm glad you say it. I can't wait to brutalize blacks and Asians. Let's get out there. Like, he's kind of like, okay. But he goes out in the street and he sees this, like, they're just grabbing everybody on this. If you fuck you for living here, essentially. Like, hey, man, this is my front porch. I can sit on my front porch. You're here in 10 seconds. Your ass going to be in that wagon, too. And the theory kind of makes sense. Like, you know what? People get shot in this block. And if everyone in this block is in jail for the night, they can't be shot or shoot. And if we do that enough, the murder rate will go down because it has to, right?
Well, I mean, if you're So let's put this in coder terms, because we just talked about that. Like, if you go into the shop and you start stringing together patches on your code and you don't document shit and you just like do quick fixes, you are creating tech debt. And this is creating goodwill debt with the people in Baltimore, right? Like, sure, it's a solution that might bring your numbers down and artificially, but at the end of the day, it is not instilling goodwill. It's in fact doing the opposite, and it's causing you to have far greater problems policing in the future than you do even right now.
Yeah. And it's like perverse incentives. Like, you know, have you ever heard of like bug bounties where like if you the programmers that are finding the bugs and documenting the bugs are getting paid to do that? Well, guess what? They're also incentivized into writing their bugs that they can easily find and fix and give me the money.
Uh-huh.
Like these tons of preserve. And you can see like Officer Jenkins like looking around like, this is fucking crazy, but okay, you know? And then they flash forward to October 2015. It's the first day on the job as new commissioner. Now we see Wayne, who is fully calcified into shitbag status.
Yeah.
And the commissioner is saying, you know, this officer who's been put on this list where he can't testify in court anymore, that he's doing witness intimidation, gangbanger type shit. It's not his first incident. And what's Wayne do? He says, free Laronde, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And the commissioner goes to talk to him, but it's like a joke, because as soon as the commissioner turns his back, the deputy commissioner is kind of like rolls his eyes, and Wayne rolls his eyes, and, oh, I'm sorry, sir, I won't ever do this again. It's just all a joke. We also go, they follow the meat wagon. We go back to 2003, this first day on the shift. They follow the meat wagon back to central processing, and it's a shit show. Yeah. The city's a district attorney is set up a little like coffee table where she is going and looking at the obvious bullshit charges. Dude. And giving him a deal. Yeah, talk about this, Jim.
Yeah, this was maybe the most infuriating thing I saw in the episode. This, like, the ways in which the system is broken and the conspiring that has to happen to get a system this broken is so incredible. Like, when you have people who are being told like, hey, just sign this waiver that you won't sue for false arrest and you can be out tonight, you know?
Yeah.
Or take what your chances. What these people don't know is that the charges are bullshit anyway. And if they just stay there overnight, which a lot of them probably can't because they probably have work the next day and they'll lose their jobs.
They got kids they got to take to school.
Right.
They don't want to stay in jail for 24 hours, maybe.
Maybe that. But if they had the luxury to be able to stay in jail for that 24 hours, then some of these, then these charges would be dropped and they could sue the city for false arrest because it's obviously what it was. And just the level of cooperation between the lawyers, the attorneys, the people enforcing the law, and the perverse like co-conspiratorial aspect of the people who are being arrested too is so fucked up, because they push them into this scenario where they have to be co-conspirators in their own cover up. Right. It's fucked up, man. I don't get how this system exists, let alone how you fix it.
This Jenkins saying like, so we're charging bullshit here. How are we going? And his partner's like, this is the line of the episode. It's like, kid, there's no dictatorship more solid than a beat cop on his post. Mm-hmm. Like, essentially, whatever we say happen, we can make happen. Yeah. We can make things stick. It's crazy. And you see a subtle
they can't make things stick, right? Because they have that jury problem too. Like, they're not actually going to be able to charge any of these people with serious offenses because all of it is bullshit. And the juries aren't on their side, but they can get out of basically anything. Like, if they say it wasn't a false arrest, they're not going to be suspended for it without pay. They might be suspended for it with pay. Who knows? Yeah. Wild.
And I'm sure they're going to make it. They've told us, but they're going to make it explicit. Like, what kind of hell these local cops can make your life if you do want to make IAD complaint and try to make it stick. Like,
right? Like, this guy who's suing Herschel, I bet he doesn't have the greatest time walking down the street.
Oh, yeah. And like I said, like, you know, like, you'll get pulled over multiple times a day. Like, explain to your boss why you're an hour late to your shift every single day. Like, even if you're sympathetic to your, like, I got to have someone who shows up on time and you get kept. It sucks. And we flash forward a year and Jenkins is still not a corrupt cop. He's with his training officer, now partner, and they're driving through the city, and he's like, look at this shithole, we don't get paid enough to fix this, there is no fixing this. They jump out a corner, they search these three boys, they find a bag of weed on one of them.
Yeah.
And the cop explains, like, there's two ways that a beat cop can get the money they're due in this place: overtime, and no one's gonna give you overtime for doing real police work. The other one is you make I don't exactly understand how this goes, but the guy says if you make enough arrests, you can overflow the day's docket and get paid twice. And I don't, but essentially it means that, like, we took three guys, one of them has a bag of weed, which who gives a shit in a sane country? But we're now going to say all three of these guys are drug accomplices, and we're all going to take them down, and we're going to let the court system figure it out.
Is that the thing? Like, they come in to, you know, testify and sit in court for the day, but their docket number doesn't get pulled, and so they have to come back the next day.
Oh, it might be. It might be. Because I know that's guess. Like why some cops like work in traffic, because ticket they write and they show up for, they get paid for that, and it's right. easy work, you know. It's better sure, than just sitting in a patrol car. And and meanwhile, while they're taking these guys, they're doing, or essentially not doing, there's a guy doing wheelies down the street that they just like watch, which is interesting because that's something that Cincinnati's been having a problem with of late, the fucking dirt and quad. Yeah, it's guess it's pretty bad in certain parts of the city, and the cops don't do anything about it. So then you get the other pressure coming. Wayne shows up at the barbecue with his medium crabs
and his lily fucking white friends. Let's say that, because like you want to say, okay, well, it's not, you know, the color of the people policing these people, but it does seem like
there's some segregation within the force too. And when you're talking about this place being a shithole and there's no fixing it, that's for sure. Like, yeah. You know, yeah, like there's some racial undertones, all that. And, you know, he's kind of shamed by his superiors bringing filet mignon and lobster tails and talking about money ain't nothing but paper. And he's ashamed, and he's looking at his wife and is like, well, why, you know, like, how do you explain to your family that you can't provide when you've got these people living high off the hog? Like, what the fuck? How do I get plugged in with this? Is there anybody getting in trouble for this? Fuck no. Mm-hmm. So then we get a little bit later in the year, and Jenkins comes up on a stopper. They got like 10 black kids on the curb. They have found a ground stash, which means, you know, the criminals aren't stupid. They come up with countermeasures. They've got some drugs hidden somewhere, not on their person. Mm-hmm. Somebody there is dealing drugs. They decided all 10 of them are going to deal drugs, and they're going to put them in the paddy wagon. And I think this is like this is setting up the Freddie Gray situation, because as he's loading them up, they're making jokes about, oh, you're all going to take this trip. You're going to really enjoy this ride. You're going to have a lot of fun in there. And his partner is slapping him on the back and being like, I've taught you well, Jenkins, for doing this shit.
Yeah.
Flash forward to 2004. Jenkins comes fired out of a cannon. There are six cops on some dude wailing the fuck out of him. He grabs some dude's leg and starts beating the shit out of it. Turns out it's another cop wearing Air Jordans because he forgot his service issued boots.
Yeah.
Fuck. How many cops does it take to beat the shit out of a dude on the ground?
As many as show up on the scene, I guess.
It must be a hell of a lot of fun just to beat the fuck out of anybody that you want to.
I don't think so. But some people apparently do. I wouldn't beat people for basically any reason, but a lot of people will. Apparently.
Yeah, it is an interesting mindset. And also, like, for why? He has no idea. He just comes flying up and he's like ready to beat this guy. Did he take a swing on an officer? It turns out, like, what was the charges they actually had? He was on an indict. So he's essentially on a crime corner after dark. And then he resisted arrest, and Jenkins beat the shit out of one of his fellow officers. So they're going to add assaulting an officer on top of that too.
Yeah. And he taunts the kid as he walks off, like, shouldn't swing at a cop. Never swing at a cop. Whatever.
Yeah, you dumb shit. You dumb ass. It's like, oh, my God. Oh, my God. How do you live in this city? So they then...
You don't? Yeah, I mean, not by choice. You're stuck in the city, right? Like,
they didn't have a circle of life, and they flash forward to 2005. Jenkins is the experienced person, the training officer that's getting a fresh recruit, and he sits down and repeats the process. Fuck everything you heard in the academy. Forget all the things you learned about search and see. And this the cycle continues. Mm-hmm. And this is bookended by Jenkins seeing his partner getting frog marched past a cell, and him, like you said, he's reflecting on what he's done, what's going to happen, et cetera, et cetera. Just kind of fretting. And that's the episode.
Yeah, it's infuriating. I expect the rest of this series to be pretty infuriating. Like you said earlier, I hope they come away with some nugget of wisdom, like an idea on how to help this situation, because it just feels hopeless a lot of times.
I don't think it feels like you're never going to get any better as long as you got this war on drugs, because the perverse incentives of doing like that's easy versus like solving rapes, arson, murder, that's hard. Mm-hmm. You know, doing actual police work is hard, but it's a hell of a lot easier if you're not just hassling people and running through their pockets. And, you know, it's the money. I don't know. It's like this country, I felt like, learned a lesson in the Al Capone days about prohibition and turned that thing around pretty quick. Like, you know, like less than a decade, you had two amendments to the fucking Constitution to take care of all this shit. Blood running in the streets. 40, 50 years on in the war on drugs. And what do we got? We got nothing good. We own the city. We got the cops owning cities. I'm running low on blood and piss. I feel like we should open up the mailbag and see if anybody's got some that they want to squirt out.
Yeah, let's do it.
You can reach us by dropping us a line at corners@baldmove.com. Give us your criminal informant tips at corners@baldmove.com. We'll see what happens.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
First up, Nikki C says, hey, fellas. I'm very excited for this show, and I love the first episode. I've been a supporter of Bald Move for around 8 years, but I think this is the first time I've felt compelled to send email feedback for a show. First time, long time. I love hearing it. Thanks, Nikki. I found the city council or city county conversations jarringly familiar. Baltimore City is not my part of the country. It's a separate, or not my part of the county. It's a separate entity with no on-paper connection to the county surrounding it. The city and county might as well be two separate large cities wrapped around each other. This is the same situation where I live with St. Louis and St. Louis County. It looks like Carson City, Nevada is the third U.S. city that operates this way outside of some weird stuff with multiple Virginia cities, but that seems a little bit different. These are apparently called independent cities, and I've included a Wikipedia link that outlines it. This creates a whole slew of problems that I'm curious to see if We Own This City explores more. For example, here in St. Louis, during the early stages of COVID, there weren't any St. Louis mandates or restrictions. There were county restrictions and then city restrictions. If the county had a mask mandate that did not include the city would have to issue its own. While the St. Louis city mayor and St. Louis county executive did a good job working together during COVID, this has not always been the case, especially with policing. Having two separate large law enforcement departments that don't even go into all the tiny departments of the community municipalities. Let me sound that shit out. Right on top of each other is not the most efficient way to keep places safe. A quick Google search shows it's been less than 10 years since cops have been even allowed to cross the county city line to make arrests. Of course, this is not the reason for the violent crime levels here in St. Louis, but it sure doesn't help, and I'm betting the same is true for Baltimore. The city-county situation is also one of the reasons Baltimore and St. Louis are always near the top of the most dangerous cities list. Not only is policing a nightmare, but in most of these articles, the statistics used do not include county data for these two cities like they do for other cities included in the list. So essentially, can have your crime statistics. This is interesting because, like, we grew up in a city. This happened when we were, like, 18, 19, 20. But they used to be that way in Indianapolis, where you had the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police, and then you had the Marion County Sheriff's Department. Marion County is Indianapolis. Indianapolis is Marion County. And they merged all that shit because there was, like, you know, this whole cities pointing at county, counties pointing at city, jurisdictional. It seems insane that any large metro area has got this built-in conflict. And not only that, but just redundant shit.
I guess I don't fully understand, like, the implications of it. I'm not plugged in enough to the law enforcement scene to know. Is it just a matter of inefficiencies, or is it a matter of, like, passing the buck? Or
I think it's all that. Like, imagine if there was a Bald Move board of directors of Jim and a Bald Move county directors of Aaron, and their identities were you had, so instead of, like, us having one boss that tells us what to do, you have two sets of bosses, two sets of vehicles that you have to maintain, two sets, and then the accountability issue. Well, when something went down and something got published wrong, was that the county of Aaron or was that the city of Jim?
Sure.
Well, and Jim can sit and point at Aaron.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's massively inefficient. It allows these games to be played where people dodge accountability. Like I said, I don't think anyone's suggesting that it would cure everything if we merged Baltimore and Baltimore counties
together. Doubt it.
But it would be one thing that at least, you know, makes things a little bit more accountable, and if anything else, you're saving money on middle management, you know?
Sure.
So, yeah, we had several people that kind of, like, had takes on that. I thought that was a good one. So I appreciate the insight there, Nikki, because it is an uncommon situation. The vast majority of places in the United States that have had, you know, situations have solved them because it's crazy, you know? And she said it's not just the cops. It's like you have separate fire departments, ambulances, everything. Like, it's crazy. Eric's next up says, hey guys, thought you'd be interested in knowing more about the Brady list as it pertains to the 25 cops that can't testify in court on the show. I attached a link explaining why or what and why the list is, but I wanted to fill you in a little bit more on why some agencies don't automatically fire their officers who end up on the list. Because that's what our question was. Like, what the fuck? If a police testimony is no good in court, then what good are they? You know, because they certainly can't solve crimes. Essentially, officers don't get fired in big cities because the unions protect them, as you kind of hint to in the podcast. Additionally, the staffing recruiting issues big cities face due to lower wages and benefits compared to their suburban counterparts make it less appealing to just fire someone rather than reassign them to a task that doesn't require them to testify. So think gate guard, metal detector operator, grant writers, etc. In smaller departments, some department heads are, let's say, getting up there in age and don't necessarily understand the ramifications of having an officer on the list due to the nuances of the Brady list or lack of training due to smaller town budgets. So they reassign the officers to some tasks where they don't have to testify, or they may look the other way and risk the Brady list being brought up in court, i.e., with low-level charges like speeding tickets or possession of marijuana. Some departments might think it's worth the gamble on a chance the suspect pleads out before you ever get to a jury trial, which happens all the time.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. Which brings me to this point. It's my understanding that technically an officer on the Brady list can still testify in court. They just risk the defense making it obvious to the jury that this cop has lied and can no longer be trusted and might cause the prosecutor to lose their case. Any good defense
sounds
attorney
like
will bring up
every cop in Baltimore.
At least 25 of them.
No, I mean, if the jurors don't give a shit about the testimony because they lie, then yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They got that right.
Any good defense attorney will bring up the Brady doctrine if they can, and prosecutors won't risk it if they can help it. All that said, there's still a lot of departments that will terminate an officer the second they do something that can land them on the Brady list. Keep in mind, however, I believe if an officer perjures themselves in a personal divorce hearing, that perjury is a Brady violation as well. Well, I mean, sure. You either follow the law and right? Don't lie in court, or you fucking don't, I guess. I guess. I mean, I guess this blows up Mosby, too, because if she's lied on her mortgage application, then
right.
That's an indictment of her character as a fucking district attorney. Thanks. Keep up the good work. Well, I appreciate it, Eric. I appreciate you informing us a bit more about that. Chris M. says, I'm a huge fan of The Wire and a reader of We Own This City book, and I'm excited to hear you are covering the HBO series based on it, and I've enjoyed your coverage of the first episode. You may or may not be aware that in 2021, Sonya Sohn, who plays Kima from The Wire, the badass lady cop, directed a film called The Slow Hustle, which is available right now on HBO Max. It covers in detail the story of one of the officers involved in We Own This City. If you're not familiar, proceed with caution, as just doing an IMDb search will give away a lot. You may want to wait till after this concludes to view it, but it should not be missed. It's a fascinating and in-depth look at a particular aspect of the story that was in the book and will surely occur in the series. Pretty hot to watch that as soon as we get done with the show. Thanks for the recommendation.
The Slow Hustle,
The Slow Hustle. That was my specialty on the dance floor. A couple of other notes regarding police body cams. While I agree they're a necessity, I think any young person who wants to become a police officer would have to think hard about taking a job where your actions are being recorded every hour of every day and could be scrutinized by anyone at any time in the future.
Yes.
They will likely have the negative impact of fewer people wanting to become a police officer, which is troubling. Food for thought.
Yes.
Yeah, but isn't that the intended purpose? Yeah, fuck that. Like, you're carrying a gun.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know who else lives under constant threat of surveillance while they're on their shift? McDonald's employees, Walmart employees, FedEx employees, like almost any employee in a retail location at any time. Like, the only place you get a respite is the fucking bathroom. And I'm pretty sure the body cams have provisions for that stuff, too. You know, like if you're beating someone's ass and you're taking a bathroom break and the camera cuts off, that's suspicious. But like, I have zero, because like, where are they going where they're not getting filmed 24/7? And again, they carry a gun. Welcome to the profession of arms. There's greater, should be greater oversight over a person.
No, I want people who are hesitant about like the actions they do being filmed to stay off the fucking police force. Like, yeah, let's get the people who. The you know, if they're doing their jobs properly, they have nothing to fear, right? I mean, that's the line that everybody wants to give. Like, if you're doing nothing wrong, you have nothing to fear from surveillance. Well, why doesn't that apply to the cops?
And it seems like an overall, if I was a cop, I would want a body cam because, like, you do get a bunch of stupid shit. You do get a lot of spurious complaints because of the bad reputation of police. And that protects good cops, you know? And like I said, I think there's ways where you can protect. I'm sympathetic to the officer's need for privacy. They want to call to their wife or their husband. They want to have a conversation with their child's principal. They want to go take a piss.
But they're not doing that on stops, right? Like, that's
right.
That's the thing. They're not doing that when they're actively on the job.
Right.
Like, sure, they do that in the office, but I kind of don't care if there's a body cam while they're walking down the halls of the PD.
Right. So that's a problem. That's a recruiting, like, you know, that's what we kind of opened up. Like, what should you pay an officer? What should the perks be? What should the benefits? Like, if you do the job right, you're a hero. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I mean, this is all happened in our lifetimes, man. Like, cops used to be, and looked up to. You taught your kids if you're in trouble, you go and talk to a cop and get an office. And like, increasingly parts of the country are not teaching their kids to go find a cop when they're in trouble.
For
good
reason.
Stay away from the cops when you're in trouble, especially if you got skin tone darker than a paper bag. Seawells writes in and says, "Hey gang, I'm glad you guys are recording a podcast for the show, given I have a lot of thoughts for the elements that will be portrayed. One, I call Maryland home sweet home. I think we discovered that in the Walking Dead podcast. Two, I am black. Three, I am almost the almost cyclical nature of drugs and drug prevention in this area. You guys didn't seem to notice the detective with McDougal is Poot. This is Detective Hawk. The other guy with Bodie that killed Wallace. Jim forgot something glass involving Nacho on Better Call Saul. Uh-huh. I did not recognize this guy was Poot from The Wire. And by far the most feedback we got this week was pointing that out. So
yeah.
Also, what the fuck happened to Hawk? Like, he's McDougal gone, got Kilpatrick, and he's like, get the fuck out of here. You can't spell affiant right. Get the hell. I don't know.
Yeah.
I hope he shows up again. In terms of this episode, how did you not smile when you see Johnny B just up there gesturing and his head gyrating, talking his tough talk?
Uh-huh.
Those lobes were swinging in the wind. I was waiting for ask you something, Rick. I think that character probably toes the line of brutality and clean police work. Well, I'm interested to see what you think after this episode.
Right.
Probably why he does grimace when the officers assault the kid during the raid. But the Omar character kind of gives him a cold reception when he makes his fun busts. I too was stunned when I realized the stick up boys were actually cops. Also, in regards to consent decree in PG County, I tried to look that one up, but there's so many of them to go through. I didn't find what I was looking for. But in the early to mid 90s, PG County was of the exodus spots for DC residents who couldn't stand living in a city amongst the crack epidemic and extreme violence that it brought with it. I was one of those families. I, being one of those families, have pleasantly enjoyed watching this area boom and become probably the best area for black families to live in the area. Also, the scene in Bel Air, Maryland may have been a weird thing for some who aren't familiar with the area. Bel Air is located in Hartford County, which isn't that important outside of the fact that Hartford County is a suburb of Baltimore, and that is one of the hot spots of the opioid crisis in the state. None of us knew anything about this, given when black kids were raised towards the end of the 90s, our entire school was plastered with no means no, and that heroin is another word for death type of stuff. While crude and perhaps insensitive to the complex topic, that and the drug awareness did work well on me and my friends to never even be interested in it. Fast forward to 2015, around the same time as the show, the Washington Post put out an article about how heroin is infesting Baltimore suburbs. And one of the most impactful pictures was a quiet neighborhood with a child crying in the baby seat with both of his parents OD'd in the front seat. I've either seen that picture or one like it, because I think that sad scene repeats a lot. Around the country in the last 10 years. This is around the time they found out about fentanyl, so you guys' surmisal was correct. Appreciate your pod, and I'll be tuning in and writing as often as I can. That's interesting, because I think that the Just Say No campaign, I mean, there's lots of statistics about the fact that it didn't do what it was supposed to do. But it also, I gotta say, it worked on me. I was a very religious kid growing up, and like, that gave me a kind of dialogue tree, because I was offered drugs in high school, and just being able to say no, I don't know. Like, if they never talked about drugs in school, I don't know if it would have gone differently. But
yeah, it's tough to say if it worked on me or if I just didn't. I wasn't presented with opportunities.
You never got offered. Well, you bailed out of high school.
Yeah, and I wasn't, like, even in the parts of high school I attended, I wasn't allowed to hang out with anybody. So, like, I couldn't really make friends in school. No one was close enough to me to think, okay, this guy might be cool if I offered him a joint or something. Like, yeah. So I don't know if it worked on me, but I think there are people that it does work on, right? I don't think it's all bullshit. And a lot of that stuff is, like, heroin's a fucking nasty drug. Fentanyl is god awful. Lethal. Opioids, like, yeah, that stuff is terrible. And I don't think anybody should do it. And a lot of the times it's just circumstance that push people to it. It's not even that they got in and said, hey, this would be a fun, cool thing to do, and then got in too deep. It's more like, God, my life is shit, and it's just made worse by everything around me. I'm looking for an escape.
I think the problem I have with the drug education in America is it's not factual. Like, it's fine to say, just say no, you shouldn't take drugs, kids, because even marijuana, like, I would be disappointed if my son started smoking marijuana, because, like, it's dangerous in the fact that it can make you comfortable being in a shitty situation. You know, it's a way that it's you can medicate your life away. Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
But, like, I also think it's not cool to tell people obvious lies about, like, things like marijuana. Yeah. And how dangerous it is compared to, like, cocaine, how dangerous cocaine is compared to, like, meth and heroin. Because what happens is, if a kid does, like, oh, God, I'm going to succumb to peer pressure, I'm going to try this for the fucking devil's lettuce, and essentially nothing but good things happen to them, then it's like, well, fuck, what else was I lied about? Was I lied about mushrooms? Was I lied about? And then you get to a point where you're at a party and you're just doing whatever pills, and then that shit gets all fucko. And it's because you lied to the kids, man.
Yeah.
You didn't say you shouldn't take marijuana because it fuzzes up your head and makes you not care about your grades as much and makes you cool with being kind of like a slacker loser and your brain's not done. It's like, you know, like fucking reefer madness.
Right.
That's the problem. Because, like, if you do cross that line and you find out, it's just like a cop. Like, the first time you steal money and nothing happens, it's like, you know, you fucking go nuts. I don't know. I don't think we should lie to our children about drugs. We should have those conversations. They should be factual conversations. Mm-hmm. Dave G says, Jim and Aaron, so glad you're covering David Simon's return to Balmer. Quick thoughts and one question. I agree that Ahmed seems to be the audience surrogate. What happened to Ahmed and Hawk, man? It's the McDougal and Steel show. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm too Simonized, but it seems like Nicole had a little too much exposition. There was a lot more. There's more than enough that I couldn't keep up with to make the rewatch well worth the extra hour. Oh, there's still more than enough, and I couldn't keep up with it to make the rewatch well worth the extra hour. That was a common complaint about this first episode, and I don't think it entirely goes, like, Steel continues to be almost exclusively expository, but
I'm liking it, but I could see why some people might not. Yeah.
Yeah, and also it feels like a side effect of the time jumble. I'm the jury's still out on whether it would have been, but I don't know how you tell the story if you just start with Sergeant Jenkins in 2003 and you, I don't know, in a 6-episode series.
And it's her role, right? She's effectively the journalist of this series, right? She's writing a report. It's gonna be a lot of exposition, so.
Says, when do you think the paper bag scene took place? When Wayne Jenkins looks older, but I don't see his sergeant stripes. Is this the young Wayne before the gun trace task force, or is it demoted but not convicted and jailed Wayne walking the beat after the 2017 arrest? I only know the background of the killing of Freddie Gray, but not the disposition of the cases against the officers involved, their subsequent BPD scandals. That's a good question. I'm guessing, just like you said, he doesn't have the sergeant stripes. He's still wearing the hat. He's not plain clothes. This is in that 2004, 2005, before he started making cases and making a name for himself. Yeah. And
is this
he's
the
on
lead
that
up
line
to the Freddie Gray stuff, or?
No, that's still away. That's 10 years
is
away.
Is it away? Okay.
So I don't know exactly, but it's early in his career where he's probably on that knife's edge between, but I don't know, he's working a beat. And like I said, I think that was a little bit much, but on the other hand, I don't know. I think that encounter could have got a lot worse. And I think it would have gotten a lot worse had you'd seen 2008, 2009 Wayne, but I don't know. Finally, Danielle S. says, as a Baltimore native who still lives in the area, I'm intrigued with all things Baltimore. Fair enough. I would be too. I'm obsessed with Baltimore.
You're right.
I lived through the Freddie Gray situation. It's a very ugly time in the city. This series, while good, definitely has me feeling like it's a The Wire reboot. Not necessarily a bad thing, just an observation. It also gave my husband Training Day vibes too. Whoa, wait till you see this episode.
Yeah, that's the thing about The Wire. I binged The Wire. I wasn't watching contemporarily with it airing on television, so I felt like there was a lot more action, a lot more movement in The Wire than this show has given me so far. But we're two episodes in, and I do remember the feeling of being pretty lost in The Wire in those first few episodes, and this has definitely struck that chord again. But yeah, I think this is very, very similar to The Wire.
I don't think it's a bad thing, because The Wire took place 20 years ago. I think a lot of people, I mean, that's one thing I hear about, like people get burnt out on the subject of police reform. It's like, oh, we've tried. And like the idea, like these cities are just permanently fucked. There's nothing you can do about it. You just got to increasingly slide into fucking Judge Dredd shit. Whereas this show shows that like a lot of things have stayed the same, but also the game's changed quite a bit too.
Yeah.
And I think anybody that starts talking about, well, why waste your time on police reform, on criminal justice reform? It's never going to, you're just rearranging it. It's not paying attention to how much the game does change. And I think, you know, The Wire also is old. It's standard definition. It's a different, like, it manifestly feels like that threshold golden age of television. I think it is time for an update. And also asking someone to watch five seasons is a hell of a lot harder than watching six episodes. So if this changes anybody's mind and starts conversations across the country, I think it's probably a good thing. But it can't ever be but a Cliff Notes version of The Wire with like updated for 2022, you know?
Yeah. Like in a Wire addendum.
And also, I just think it's like a lot of people don't understand like the cops' reaction to these. Like, how do they see efforts at criminal justice reform and that stuff too? I think that's eye opening too. So anyway, I appreciate everybody sending us feedback. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. I'm looking forward to episode 3, and we'll be here next week when the new episode drops. Until then, I'm Aaron,
and I'm Jim.
See ya.